Let me ask you to turn in your Bibles. We're going to two places in the book of Ecclesiastes. We're going to look at the end of Ecclesiastes chapter 12. And then we're also going to be looking, and more in depth at Ecclesiastes chapter 3. And as I told the Sunday school class this morning, one of the pieces of advice that I remember my father gave to me that has always served me well was that when you speak, if you're speaking on something that you need, at least one person will be blessed. So I'm going to be talking to myself this morning, and y'all are just along for the ride. If you get some accidental drive-by benefit spiritually, then I hope you'll write it down. And I know that I am largely not speaking to most of you, and I'll explain why in just a moment, but because a lot of you have not reached this stage in your life yet that I'm going to talk about. But some of you are getting there, and all of you will get there. And so what I say may not be a benefit today, but it will certainly be of benefit in the future. And so we're going to look at what I call the nails and goads of God. Now, when I was young, I felt like this statement, I actually have this on a magnet sticker on the side of my refrigerator. It says, if it weren't for physics and law enforcement, I'd be unstoppable. Y'all ever felt like that when you're young? I can tell you when I had a 1969 Mustang with a Cleveland 351 racing engine and an overhead three-quarter cam and an 850 Holley four barrel and a Hurst transmission and Krager mags, I felt like that. That was a lot of years ago, okay? But I felt unstoppable, and pretty much was at the time. And you think, well, I'm only limited by physics. But something happens to that feeling along the way in life. In fact, recently on Focus on the Family, they had a show where a couple was talking about how a lot of marriages experience problems after they've been married 20, 30, sometimes 40 years because they haven't dealt with these issues. A lot of women, and it turns out women are about a decade ahead of men in this regard, women get in their 30s and they've been raising kids for a while, and one day they look up and they ask themselves the question, is this worth it? All I'm doing is changing diapers and feeding and cleaning, and it's over and over again. It's not like you clean the house and it stays that way, right? Especially if you have kids. So it seems like it's a constant struggle. And after a while, a lot of women in their early to mid-30s start asking the question, is this godly straight life, is this being a wife and mother really all it's cracked up to be? Now, men, because I think we're probably developmentally slower because we operate out of one hemisphere where you ladies operate out of two, it takes us to our mid-40s usually to figure this out. And then one day we look up and we feel like the job we're in has become a hamster wheel squeaking in a cage that we're constantly running and running and running and doing this and that, and yet we never quite get ahead. And it seems like no matter how much work you do, there's never any rest. They keep shoveling the work on you as fast as you can get it done, sometimes faster. And then when the paycheck gets direct deposited to your account, you don't really enjoy taking that check to the bank yourself and looking at all the numbers. And then on top of that, all of the check is spent before you got it in the bank because you've got all your payments maybe automatically scheduled to go out. And then you know there's a certain amount that has to come out for groceries and a certain amount that comes out for insurance and a certain amount, hopefully, that comes out for tithe and a certain amount that maybe you're putting toward your future retirement. And by the time everything comes out, you realize that you're not buying a jet ski that month because you don't have the money for it, or you can't really afford to go out and looking for the new car that you saw at the State Fair of Texas car show last week when you happened to be there on a Friday afternoon or something like that. And then you think, I'm doing all this to earn a living, and then when I come home, what? Well, the kids have their, especially as kids get older, they start having their own agenda and their own schedule, and as a dad, you don't feel like you're really a part of anybody's life anymore. And then your wife is busy, and because she's having to shuttle the kids to this, that, and the other thing, and maybe she has some of her own obligations. And one day you look up as a man somewhere in your 40s and 50s, and you think, I feel irrelevant. I feel like I don't matter. I feel like my presence doesn't make a difference anymore. I'm just here to pay the bills. And a lot of men get feeling this way, so much so that one author by the name of Bob Buford has written a book called Halftime, and it's an excellent book. I would encourage any of you men in your mid-30s and above that you need to get this book. And it's available as an audio book, too, so if you don't have time to read, you've got time to listen. It's not a long book, but it talks about the fact that most of us as men, when we're young, we work to achieve success in our career. And so we work hard to get success in our career, and then one day we look up and we have success in our career, but we start thinking, but is my life counting for anything? Is my life significant? And so a lot of men go through a midlife crisis where they want to move from doing what they had to do to take care of their families and be successful to doing something that'll count. And if you're a Christian, to count for eternity. And even if you're not a Christian, you want to leave behind some kind of legacy that lives beyond your life. And so you start thinking, how can I live for significance? And of course, actually, I think maybe do guys in their 20s good to read this book, because Bob Buford makes the argument that guys in their 20s, instead of trying to strive for success, they ought to strive for significance, and the success would come along with it. Do what's eternally significant. Do what really you enjoy, what you can be passionate about. Do what serves the Lord now, and God will bring the success. But for those of us who didn't get this book in time, it's saying you need to start finding significance now. Start doing something that counts for eternity now, and that's the benefit that accrues to you. So at some point in your life, all of you are going to get to the stage where you're going to say, what's the point of it all? What's the reason for it all? Why am I still here? Am I just spinning myself on a hamster wheel and going round and round in circles? And am I actually relevant, or do I just not make a difference anymore? Why am I still sucking up air and fogging up a mirror? You'll eventually get to that stage. Most of you are probably not there yet, but maybe a few of you have experienced this. And so we have some things I'm going to call the goads of God. And let me give just a little background to it. You will remember there was an 18-year-old young man by the name of Solomon. And God came to this 18-year-old in a dream. And he says, I will give you anything you want. Just name it. You tell us what it is. Whatever you want, I'll give it. And so he asked for wisdom and understanding so that he would know how to go out and come in before the people of Israel. And God gave it. He gave it so abundantly that the Bible tells us that Solomon knew about the hyssop branch, you know, all of its benefits. He knew about the cedars of Lebanon. He knew about the kingdom of animals. He knew about, he basically was like a biologist and a zoologist and a geologist and a whole bunch of other ologists all wrapped into one. He had more wisdom than anyone alive. It even compares him to about five men of the day. One guy's name was Chalcol, and there were several others. It compares him to the most famous wise men alive that day and said that his wisdom exceeded them all. So he had lots of wisdom. And at the end of his life, you see, there's a godly wisdom and there's an earthly wisdom. James talks about that. And Solomon tried both. In fact, is at some point in his life, Solomon got thinking to himself this question. What's the point of it all? What's the point of being righteous all the time? What do I have to show for life? And so he thought, I'm not satisfied. So he tried a bunch of things, and they're covered in the book of Ecclesiastes. One thing he tried is he tried works. He built great new buildings. He engaged in great public works project. He labored to leave behind legacies of buildings and architecture and new waterways and things that would bless the city of Jerusalem and the nation of Israel. And yet, He says that after trying all those things, he says, but all I had under the sun was vanity. So then he decided that to try women. And of course, we know that in his life, Solomon had 300 wives and 900 concubines, or as the little girl in Sunday school said, 900 porcupines. But he tried that. And so he had all of these women. And yet he never found satisfaction in women. And then he tried wealth, and so he accumulated more wealth than anyone in the world had ever seen up to this point in time. And if you wanted to know where all the gold of Ophir was going to, it was going to King Solomon, and yet didn't find satisfaction in all of his wealth. And then he tried wine and merriment and entertainment. And so he would throw big parties and they'd have wine. And there were drunken revelings and people telling jokes and entertainers coming. And the Judean version of court jesters to entertain them. And they would have these big feasts. And yet after all of that, Solomon still said, all is vanity. It's emptiness. It's nothingness. And so when he's tried wine and women and wealth and work and entertainment and partying, he gets to the end of his life and he finally tells us what's really important to him. Now, wise men would often defend their worldview. And when someone defends their beliefs, it's called an apologetic. And so if you go to seminary, one of the courses you get to take is a course in apologetics, and it means how to defend Scripture, how to defend the gospel, how to make a reasoned argument for why you believe what you believe. And it was some of the most enjoyable classes that I had at Southwestern Seminary in Fort Worth were my classes in apologetics and to making a defense of the gospel. But they had apologetics even back in Solomon's day, and we would call them cultural apologetics because different wise men who had different perspective on things would often write down or record their defense of their worldviews. And this is what Solomon is doing in Ecclesiastes. He is putting forth all of his experiences and the conclusion he comes to at the end of his life, and he's putting it together for a Gentile audience. And think about this. Daniel and his three friends, they were wise men. The Queen of Sheba was considered one of these kind of people of that day, and she went around collecting wisdom from others. But Ecclesiastes was written to a Gentile audience. One of the reasons we know this, there is no mention of Abraham. There's no mention of the covenants. There's no mention of anything, quite frankly, that's of any importance to a Jew. And there were lots of Gentiles in Jerusalem. You got to remember, when Solomon collected his 300 wives and his 900 concubines/porcupines, and when he collected those, he never just got the woman, but he would marry basically a woman who was a princess of some other country for political reasons. And when she came with her dietitians, she came with her dressers, she came with her hairdressers, she came with her cosmetologists, she came with an entire staff of pagan Gentile people, and they came and they stayed in Jerusalem to minister to that woman's particular needs that she had. And when you take, let's say that there's 5 or 10 people for every one of those 1,200 wives, suddenly you've got a fairly significant Gentile population inside Jerusalem. I don't know if Ecclesiastes was written to one person or to a group of Gentiles, but Jerusalem is also a world trade center, so there were Gentiles constantly coming through at the time. So I want you to look at verse 11, and I've got just verse 11 here on the screen, but if you've got your Bibles open, I'd like to read 11 through the end of the chapter. He says, "The words of the wise are as goads and as nails fastened by masters of assemblies, which are given from one shepherd. And further by these, my son, be admonished. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole of man." And your King James says whole duty, but you'll notice duty is italicized, which means it's not in the original Hebrew. He just says, this is the whole of man. In other words, that's the whole reason for man, is to fear God and keep his commandments. "For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil." So verse 11, to focus on it once again, "The words of the wise are as goads and as nails fastened by the masters of assemblies, which are given from one shepherd." Now, You'll notice he talks about two different things here. One is he talks about a goat. And if you look on the front of your bulletin, there's a picture of a goat. It was often a stick with a sharp ending on it. Sometimes it was just a piece of bamboo that had been sharpened on one end, and it might have some extra little leaves for tickling. And so you'd stick it in the back of the animal, first try to tickle his legs to get him to move. And if that didn't work, you would jab the sharp stick in the back of the animal's legs to get him to move. I remember being in Troop, Texas many years ago, and given the opportunity, it's the first time in my life, to ride a mule. And I have been on two mules in my life, and I can vouch for the fact that there is a reason we say as stubborn as a mule. They were stubborn. This mule actually sat down on his backside and refused to get up off his backside to move. Now, I had another mule. I was in Yosemite National Park years ago, and I was preaching a revival in the Sierra National Mountains and largely to a group of young people, and we went on this ride, and I dropped. We're on a trail where one mule's following the other. I dropped the cover to my camera lens, and I thought this mule would understand what a horse would understand if you pull back on the reins. All he understood is he was supposed to walk the trail with the other mules. And I had to work pretty hard to convince that mule that when I said stop, I meant stop. I finally had to take the little knot in the end of the reins and slap it between his ears, because that's a good way to get an equestrian animal's attention. And so I got his attention, finally stopped, got off, got my lens, and then as soon as I was back on, he was following the rest of the group. But they're stubborn. And I wish maybe with that first mule I encountered that sat on his backside that I'd had one of these goats, because I could have prodded him a little bit, and I think I could have convinced him to get up. So goat is something that motivates us to an action that we might not take without that motivation. And then he also refers to nails, and the word here is the idea of a tent peg. A nail is something you use to fasten something down so that it isn't swayed by the weather. It isn't carried away by the breeze. And so sometimes we need things to get us moving, and other times we need things to anchor us down, and God has both. And so the goads are the things that make us go to God, and the nails are the things that the principles in life to which our life needs to be fastened. Now, let's just read Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Well, I'm going to go ahead and read it now. I've got it on a slide later. Let's just go ahead and read it now. Ecclesiastes 3, verse 1. To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under the heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to get and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to cast away. A time to rend and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time of war and a time of peace. What profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? I have seen the travail which God has given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also he hath set the world in their hearts, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. I know that there is no good in them, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life. And also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing shall be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And God doeth it that men should fare before him. Now, we ask this question, what's the point? Because we're given a lot of examples in Ecclesiastes of things that Solomon strived for and yet didn't bring him any joy, didn't bring him any fulfillment. Think about this. We had three dogs. We came home from Jim Pell's house with four dogs. I told Jim Pell this was a real test of my friendship with him, that he sent me home with a Labrador Retriever. But the lab actually may be the only dog worth keeping. We may get rid of the other ones. I don't know. The lab and the Border Collie. The Dalmatian, if anyone even wants a Dalmatian, see me. No, Judy's shaking her head no. Judy likes the dog. Arthur likes the dog, but, you know, I don't know. I like calm dogs, and the Dalmatian is anything but calm. But the fact of the matter is, eventually, 14, 15 years down the road, your dog will die. Someday you'll die too. And guess what? You both turn into the same kind of dust in the ground. So what's the point? Or you work hard, you make lots of money, but then when you leave this earth, you're leaving it to other people, and the other people may not appreciate the wealth that you have left them, and they may not even use it wisely, all the things that you worked for so hard. So what's the point? And so at some point, a lot of us wind up in despair, and it's prolific. Now, you may not be able to see these three captions I found on a website, and this website lets you post short little glitches of feeling. There, that upper left-hand corner one, this was the initial post on this particular thread of people. And he says, what's the point in life? I'm not depressed or going to kill myself. I just feel like there's no point in life. The next response to that thread was the middle one. It says, I'm in the same boat, man. However, I'm beginning to consider ending it. There really isn't any point. And then the third guy replied, he says, well, according to your genes, it's just to pass them on, that's it. So in other words, this guy that thinks he has the helpful solution, he says, the only reason you're here is to pass on your genes to somebody else, and then it's over. Now that's despair. Despair comes from a view that doesn't include God in its thinking. And in fact, here's a little cartoon, and you see, of course, this is that typical view of evolution that we are taught in schools to believe, and which is against Scripture. But you see the lizard crawling out of the water. He says, "Eat, survive, reproduce," and then he grows a tail and longer legs, and it's "Eat, survive, reproduce," and then it's a bigger lizard, "Eat, survive, reproduce," and then it's an ape, "Eat, survive, reproduce," and then finally you have a man standing there saying, "What's it all about?" And that's really the way evolutionists primarily in this world are, is they believe we all just came from the ocean. We were an amoeba who somehow or other slithered up on ground after we became a fish, and then we turned into lizards, and then we turned into a monkey, and we climbed up in a tree and got a degree and a PhD in biology, and now we teach college. And we look at this, and people are saying, what's the point of it all? Because they have absolutely no God in their perspective whatsoever. So what is the point? Here's the point. The point is, and this is the point of the whole book of Ecclesiastes, that there is no point to this life unless there's something that transcends this life. You and I, there's no point to our living unless there's something beyond us. Paul said it this way in 1 Corinthians 15:19. If in this life only we have hope in Christ, we are of all men most miserable. And if you look around you, you will see a world that is miserable because they think that getting on in the rat race is all there is to this life, and they're just waiting for the exit. So a conclusion we can draw from the book of Ecclesiastes is that the way you're living is not worth living unless you're investing in eternity. Now, Ecclesiastes 3 has had this theme that there's a time for everything. And fact is, it lists 14 different pairs of things. And I'm going to use terms that I don't exactly like, but I'm going to call them the positives and the negatives. It's not that everything on the negative list is bad and everything on the positive list is good, but I'm just going to use that term for lack of a better one. But he mentions 14 positives: being born, planting, healing, building up, laughing, dancing, embracing, gathering, getting, keeping, sowing, speaking, love and peace. And then he follows that with a list of 14 negatives that are the opposites: dying, reaping, killing, tearing down, weeping, mourning, refrain from embracing, casting away stones, lose, casting away other belongings, rending or tearing, keeping silence, hate, and war. And so really, if you do the math here, he's got 14 positives and 14 negatives. So 14 minus 14 is what? Zero. And the word for zero in the Old Testament is vanity. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Vanity means emptiness. It means nothingness. It means that there's nothing there. Now, So he says that life under the sun, with all of its different things that are appointed to us, is a big zero. Now here's where I think you need to start writing down notes. One of the reasons we experience this is that God has placed limitations on our life. So I'm going to give you a list of limitations on how God has limited your life and why we have those limits. Number one, you are limited in your control of life. You are limited in your control of life. You notice that when we start getting this list in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, he says to everything there's a season. And then when we get down after this long list of 14 things, he says in verse 11, he, talking about God, has made everything beautiful in his time. In other words, God has a time, and there's different seasons of our life, and the reality is we're not largely under control. We don't control the weather. I believe that from the time we came in to the church today till about 8 o'clock tonight, the weather's going to drop 30 degrees. It's going to be cold tonight. Some of you will be thinking, oh, we need to turn on the heat. What, any of you in charge of that phenomena? I certainly wouldn't. Nobody even asked my advice. We're not in control of the stock market. Sometimes we're not in control of our career. I'm not in control of my Dalmatian. I can't control, and quite frankly, I'm not really in control of my kids either. They kind of have their own agenda at times. I wish I was more in control of my career. I've been on a project for a year now that I'm really just starting to hate. And I am this week I'm getting to do something different. Thankfully, I'm flying to Washington, D.C. to work with the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol Department this week. And so that at least will be a change. But when I come back, I will still have my regular job to get back to, and or this assignment I've been on for more than a year. And I wish I didn't, but I'm not really in control of it. I kind of have to finish the task. And let me just tell you something. The older your kids are and the older you are, the more you will realize you're not nearly as much in control as when you were young and went to the first ATI seminar and figured out everything a dad is supposed to do. You're not in control. You voice your opinion, but very often it gets ignored. Your wife has other priorities. Your kids have other priorities. You're just not in control. There's a lot we're not in control. So what we try to control things. Maybe a lot of people try to control things through deception. We deceive things hoping that we can control. I have an example of that. I'm not going to use it. We manipulate. We try to manipulate the circumstances, manipulate the information. I only tell people what we want them to hear in hopes that they'll cooperate with us. We rationalize our behavior even though we know it's wrong. We argue with people. These are all things we try to do to control. And sometimes we just are frustrated by our environment, our children, our finances, our future. This is, and here's the thing you need to understand, when you are frustrated by your lack of control, it is a goad of God. It's him sticking you in the rump with a sharp stick to move you to ask him to be in control. Let me say that again. When you are frustrated by your lack of control, this is the first goad of God to goad you to ask him to be in control of what's out of control. Because guess what? You are not going to be in control, but he can be. So next time you're feeling frustrated, Dad, and I'm going to talk more to dads than I talk to you moms because I understand that world better. But you ladies, this goes for you too. When you feel like life is out of control, then do this. Ask God to be in control. That's your goad. That's the thing to move. Well, not only are we limited in our control, we're limited in our comprehension. We're limited in our comprehension. Look at the last half of chapter 3, verse 11. He says he's made everything beautiful in his time. He's also set the world in their hearts so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. He says we would all like to know how things are going to end up. We'd like to understand issues from end to end. We want to understand the whole process. We want to know how you get from one to that. And in my work, I have people, customers ask me all this all the time. Okay, how does the data get from this end to this end? We want to see the path that the data takes. So how does the data get from one place to another? And wouldn't you like to know how everything in your life is going to work out? How God used in an illness that made you walk with a cane for 8 years, how he's going to use that in your life to benefit anybody later? Or what it... how God is going to use you sitting in a doctor's office at UT Southwestern Medical Center and they say, I don't know, we think maybe you have cancer. How is that going to be used? Or how is it going to be used that you and your family went through a trauma and lost a child? How's God going to use that in your lives? How's God going to use the suffering you're going through now with one of your children or with your job or your career, and you're going through maybe what is one of the most difficult times of your life? How can God use that? Wouldn't it be nice if we could see the outcome and see the other side of our problem and the other side of our issue and know where we were going to wind up? Wouldn't that be awesome? But the reality is, we don't. I remember my dad was, I guess, a man of outrageous extremes. You know, he was saved by a Gideon Bible, so I'm thankful we're having the Gideons later this month, and I hope you'll give generously to that. But even after he was saved, he still had a lot of carnal in him, as many of us do. And so he was kind of a man of extremes at times. But it seemed like that when I was a sophomore at Texas A&M University, that my dad was finally starting to get his life together. And we had had kind of a strained relationship for a couple years, but he finally started acting like a good dad should. And it was at that very moment when he was just starting to act like a good dad that he was struck by a stroke. He'd had two previous strokes in life, but this one left him paralyzed on the right side of his body for the rest of his life, and he never could talk again. He could occasionally get a few words out and struggle, and my stepmother and I were both fairly adept at the idea that he was trying to convey. But it was frustrating. It was frustrating for him. And I used to say that when I got to heaven, one of the questions I was going to ask God is, why did God wait until my dad was getting his act together to allow him to have a stroke? Now, I haven't thought of that question in a lot of years. I don't ask that question anymore. I probably won't remember that question when I see Jesus, because I'll have so many other things on my mind that will be insignificant to me. And I'm sure a lot of your questions will melt away, because you will suddenly know, even as you are known, the Bible says. But right now, there's just a lot of unsolved mysteries. And I don't know about you, I don't like unsolved mysteries. It bugs me, especially as an engineer. I want to know what the problem is. And yet I think sometimes it's a little bit like looking at the Grand Canyon. Now, I must confess, I've only flown over the Grand Canyon. I've not been to it. But I grew up climbing the rocks and hills in Palo Duro Canyon out in West Texas. And it's home to me. And we were there not that many months ago. And my kids and I went climbing. And Christiana pushed me to new heights in the climbing. She was stubborn and determined she was going to climb up all the way, basically even with the canyon wall. And it was a good 2 hours going up, and it was so scary coming down. I didn't know if I'd ever make it back to civilization. But at any rate, we made the trip. I came back. I was so dehydrated that about 200 yards from the car, I thought I saw my wife holding a glass of iced tea. But in reality, my wife and Hope had left with the car to go find a restroom somewhere, and they didn't come back for about 20 minutes. But Judy was standing there just as real as day with iced tea. That's the most dehydrated I've ever been to have a hallucination like that. But canyons are beautiful. But if you stand on the rim of the Palo Duro Canyon, you're standing on the rim of the Grand Canyon, you're just kind of in awe. Now Palo Duro Canyon's only about 22,000 acres. The Grand Canyon is many times that much larger, and it got the Colorado River running through it. And yet, imagine if you stood on the rim and you were not allowed to look at the canyon. You had to use a telescope that showed you the other end of the canyon, and you could only see 1 square foot of the canyon at a time. Now, wouldn't that be kind of boring, looking at 1 square foot at a time? And you would say, well, that looks like dirt. Oh, that looks like more dirt. Oh, there's a rock. It looks like more rocks. But it wouldn't be very beautiful, because you can't see the whole picture. Well, that's how I approach life. God sees the whole picture, but I am limited to looking at one little microcosm of time where my life is at right now, and all I can see is the right now, and I can't understand the end from the beginning. I can't tell where this suffering is going. I can't see the reason for the junk I'm in, and I can't see how it's going to turn out, and that frustrates me.
But when you are frustrated by your lack of comprehension, what do? Well, if you're in school and you're taking math and you suddenly can't understand the Pythagorean theorem, or you can't understand why there is a different, when you're in trigonometry and you have to memorize the rules for sine and cosine and you have to figure all this out and you're frustrated, what kids do, a variety of things. One is they just attack the teacher. Well, I don't understand this, but that's because the teacher's no good. This teacher's a really lousy teacher, or I would understand this. And if they can't attack the teacher, then they'll attack the subject. Why do I need to know math anyway? I knew one dad whose daughter says, she's trying to do math homework, she gets frustrated and says, "Why do I need to do math anyway?" And he says, "Well, what do you want to be when you grow up?" And his daughter says, "Well, I want to be a wife and a mom. That's all I want to be." So he takes her to the kitchen, he takes her to a cookbook, and he opens up the cookbook, because she had said, "Why do we need numbers?" And he looked on the recipe page of the cookbook. He says, "You see any numbers there?" And his daughter goes, "Yeah, I see numbers there." And he says, "Now, where are you going to go get the food? How are you going to pay for the food?" She says, "Well, I'm going to use the checkbook." So he goes and gets the checkbook open, opens up, says, "You see any numbers there?" She says, "You got the message. You kind of have to do math whether you want to or not. It's part of life." And so we attack the subject. And then if that doesn't work, we just attack ourselves. We say, "Well, I'm just not gifted at this. I'm just stupid. I can't do it." And probably all of you parents have heard some kid do one of those three things at some point in time. But the reality is that God has filled our lives with a whole lot of things we will never understand. He has made us live a life of mystery. Richard mentioned in his sermon last week that the Lord's Supper is a mystery. I agree with that statement. It's something we'll never completely understand, because even though it's largely symbolic in nature, Paul said that people in the church at Corinth had suffered sickness because they weren't regarding the Lord's Supper with sufficient reverence. So it means it's more than just a symbol. Otherwise, God wouldn't judge you for taking it improperly. There's a lot of mysteries, but there's all kinds of mysteries to life. And what it's supposed to do is supposed to goad us. It's supposed to stick us in our rump and make us ask God for wisdom. That's what it's really about. So that we'll humble ourselves and become a recipient of God's grace. So when you say, "I don't like not knowing the answer to this problem," it is a goad from God to seek His wisdom. James 1:5, "If any man lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men liberally and upbraideth not." So we're limited in our control of life. We're limited in our comprehension of life. We're also limited in our enjoyment of life. Dilbert's one of my favorite cartoons. And in this Dilbert cartoon, Dilbert seems to get the world I work in. Here's a guy going to Catbert. Catbert is the evil HR director, if you don't know who Catbert is. And he's never sympathetic. And so here's an employee saying, "Every time I get near my sales bonus level, the pointy-haired boss raises the target." And Catbert replies, "Ha ha, that's the funniest thing I've ever heard. He just yanks it away, ha ha." And the employee says, "I was hoping for some support." And Catbert says, "Well then, buy a cane and talk to the tail." And isn't that funny how you... That's true. I've known salespeople that every time they meet their sales quota, they raise the quotas. So it's harder to succeed the next time. There's a book called "Who Moved My Cheese?" And what it is, it's talking about if you're in a maze and you're the rat running in the maze trying to get the cheese, about every time you get to the cheese, somebody moves it. And it's talking about how this is a phenomenon in life, that every time we're just about to the point we're going to enjoy something, we've just about completed something, then somebody moves the goal line. In Ecclesiastes 3, 12 and 13, he says, "I know there's no good in them but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life, and that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor is the gift of God." Let me throw you a thought maybe you hadn't thunk before. And that is that enjoyment is a gift from God. If you enjoy your job, it's a gift from God. If you enjoy getting to go fishing on the weekend, that's a gift from God. I took some time this week. I had a project to work on, but I decided one of the blessings of my job is I can do it from just about anywhere. So I got in my car and I went to East Texas and spent 3 days there. And I would work for a while on my computer, and then I would walk out on the balcony because I could see the marina, and I could see the sunrise in the morning came up on my left, and the sunset at night came up on my right. I could see both from the balcony. Something about staring at a lake just makes me happy. I wish I'd have had time to go fishing while I was there. I didn't. But I just, you know, to be able to go somewhere and enjoy a lake, that's a gift from God. It's a pleasure. It's something, it's good. Ecclesiastes 5:19, a couple chapters over. Look at this verse. Every man also to whom God has given riches and wealth and has given power to eat thereof and to take his portion and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. So there's two gifts in that passage. It says, one, God gives us our wealth. Next time you think that you're all that because you earned a paycheck and you've got some money in the bank, you need to know that Deuteronomy 8 says that it's the Lord thy God that giveth thee power to get wealth. Every dollar in your bank account came from the Lord, even though you had a responsibility to earn it. But without him, you wouldn't have a dime. Just remember that. But he says getting wealth is from God, but also being able to rejoice in it, to be able to enjoy it. It's not a sin, by the way, to enjoy the money you make. It's a gift from the Lord. Now, we need to keep it in balance, and we need to make sure we don't love money, but it's a gift of the Lord. So basically, we could summarize Ecclesiastes with a couple of statements, and I'm not clever enough to think up stuff like this. Dr. Jim Berg at Bob Jones University made these statements. He said these are the themes of Ecclesiastes. Life is supposed to taste like cardboard if you insist on eating the box. Life is supposed to taste like cardboard if you insist on eating the box. Now, I'll clarify what he means in just a minute. He also said, you can collect all your toys, but God dispenses the batteries, and without the batteries, your toys won't work. So imagine it this way. Let's say that this afternoon, after you leave the baby shower and everything else, you go to a place called Empty Mart. And you have heard that their motto is satisfaction guaranteed. And you decide, I want some satisfaction. So you first of all go to the materialism department and you look around, and finally a sales associate comes up to you and says, I can't find satisfaction. Where is it? He says, oh, we don't have materialism in this. We don't have satisfaction in the materialism department. He says, well, it says right here, satisfaction guaranteed on your ad. And he says, well, you need to go to a different department. And so you leave the materialism department and you go to the power and prestige department. You look all around and you can't find satisfaction there. So you ask a sales associate, where do you keep the satisfaction? I'm looking for it. And they said, oh, well, you're in the wrong department. You'll have to go somewhere else. So you go to the entertainment department. Surely you'll find it there. And you look all around the entertainment department and you can't find satisfaction because it's not in the entertainment department. And you say, where in the world is this satisfaction? Because your ad says satisfaction guaranteed. And they said, well, it's in another department. And so you go to lust and sensuality department. You can't find it there. You go to the friendship and relationships department. You can't find it there. The reality is while they gave you a slogan, satisfaction guaranteed, it's not on the shelf. Y'all ever done that? You ever gone to a store to get something that was advertised and they no longer had it? Car dealers do this all the time. They put an ad, it's called a loss leader, for a really cheap car that looks like, oh man, that would meet my needs and it's super cheap, I'm going to go get it. And inevitably, when you show up for it, oh well, that car's already been sold. It's no longer. And sometimes it's just a dishonest trick. By the way, this is exactly what Solomon did. He tried wine, he tried women, he tried prestige, he tried fame, he tried wealth, he tried works, he tried everything, and yet never could find satisfaction. So where do you find satisfaction? You'll never find it in the components of life. You'll only find it in the creator of life. Let me say that again. You will never find satisfaction in the components of life. You will only find it in the creator of life. When you can't find satisfaction, it's a goad from God to spend time with him and find satisfaction in him. Now, I'm going to say something, and I don't want you to misinterpret me, so listen carefully. I don't want you leaving here saying, well, Brother Roland's not a big believer in marriage. I am. I've got 38 years of marriage to show for it. But let me tell you something, you will never find satisfaction in your mate. Because God never intended that your mate provides all of your satisfaction. He is our satisfaction. When I was growing up, cigarette advertising was still largely legal, and you saw billboards everywhere. And I remember one particular brand of cigarettes called Carlton. and they had an ad, and it says Carlton, the one that really satisfies. Have you ever thought about that? If a cigarette really satisfied, you'd smoke one and you'd never want another one your whole life because you'd be satisfied. If the prime rib at your favorite steak restaurant really satisfied, you'd go there, have one last meal, you'd never need to eat again. Problem is, it doesn't satisfy. It just satiates temporarily, but it doesn't satisfy. And if you expect your husband or your wife or your mom or your dad or your children to satisfy, and I do hope you can always be satisfied to stay with what God has given you, but if you expect them to provide satisfaction, you will never find it because satisfaction is not in the components of life, it's only in the creator of life. And you should write that saying down. So let's skip to the end. The nails. We found all these goads. We get frustrated because we can't control life. We get frustrated because we can't comprehend life. We get frustrated because we don't even get to enjoy life to the degree that we would like to. And yet all of these frustrations are goads to move us to God. But we need some anchors. We need some principles that lock us down in understanding how God brings satisfaction. And so here they are. Why does God limit our lives? He does it to teach us eternity. And that's what Ecclesiastes says. He says, He has set the world in their heart so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. God has put eternity in our hearts. Verse 14, I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. That's eternity. Nothing shall be put to it nor anything taken from it, and God doeth it that men should fear before Him. Y'all ever known a good person that just left the planet way too soon? I had a best friend named Arthur. Well, I called him Artie for short. My son is named after him. And I had a grandfather that I never met named Arthur too, but really and truthfully, my best friend was very influential on me. And we were born about 5 hours apart. We went everywhere as twins. Artie's dad had to often explain what Artie would refer to me as his twin brother, and his dad would say, not fraternal. And in other words, we weren't really twins. He was making that clear. But Artie was such a great guy. When he was 5 years old, he had to have his first valve replacement on his heart because he was born with a valve that didn't close properly. And then when we were 15... Artie finished being an Eagle Scout at the age of 15. Not many young men do that at that age. In fact, as I still have the newspaper clipping that they presented his Eagle Scout award to him while he was in a hospital bed at what is now Baylor Hospital in Irving, Texas. And I have that newspaper clipping at home because I was there at the time. But he had to have another heart transplant, not a transplant, but another valve put in his heart. They removed the valve and put in a pig valve. And so Artie seemed to be fine for about a year and a half, but then started having some problems. And it turns out that the government had put a recall on the valve that had gone into his heart. So Artie started his scar tissue from the surgery caused his artery to go from being wide down to being very narrow, and wherever the blood cells would hit that narrowing part of his artery, the blood cells would rupture and die. And so Artie was becoming anemic, and he had moved out to El Paso, Texas, and I flew out to spend some time with him, spent a week in El Paso. His dad managed the Shamrock Hilton Hotel out there, so we stayed in the hotel. We got to eat in the restaurant anytime we were hungry. We went out and rode horses. We did lots of things together, but Artie was pale and getting weaker constantly. I remember rescuing him one time because Artie was a nut. He was riding on the horse, and he just thought it'd be fun to turn around backwards in the saddle so that he could look at me as I was following. So he turns around backwards in the saddle, and he's joking. And about this time, the horse sensed that he was headed toward the barn. And this horse was what you call a barn runner. That's a horse that when he knows he's headed toward the barn, he speeds up to get back to the barn sooner. And all of a sudden, this horse takes off in a run with Artie backwards in the saddle. And Artie is trying, and there's no saddle horn, by the way, on the back end of the saddle because you were not supposed to ride backwards. And so he had nothing to hold on, and Artie started coming off the side of the horse like this, and I see a pile of railroad ties coming up behind his head. And so I did the only truly heroic thing I've probably done in my whole life, and I raced my horse up in front of Artie's horse and cut him off, and we stopped about 3 feet short of Artie's head being bashed in by railroad ties. He was a nut. I remember that before he went in for his last surgery, Artie went to a mall, and he went to a candy store and bought a big box of candy, and he went all around Sears and JCPenney handing out candy to the people that worked at the store. I mean, that was the way Artie was. He was brightening people's lives. 3 weeks before our 17th birthday, he went to Houston, Texas to have Dr. Denton Cooley, who pioneered heart transplants, to work on him to try to replace that valve. But the walls of Artie's heart had grown about this thick from scar tissue. And they put him on life support. They did the whole transplant, and then his mom called me, or his dad called me, and told me that Artie was having trouble. They couldn't get him restarted, couldn't get his heart beating again because of the thickness of the heart. And I remember getting on my knees and begging God to take me and leave Artie instead. That's how much I loved him and how much better a person I thought he was than I was. But for reasons I don't understand, I can't comprehend, and I had no control of the situation, God decided to leave me and take Artie. That was hard. Artie was so much part of my life that it seemed like he was with me every day for the next few years in a way I can't describe to you. And when I think of him and I think of some other people that I have buried over the years that were friends and they were young still in their age, and then I see ungodly men living a really long life. Now you wonder, why is Richard Dawkins still breathing air when he is such an enemy of God? Why did George Burns, who was a very ungodly comedian, live to be 100 years old? And yet good people are taken from us. See, that bugs me. It's beyond my control and it's beyond my comprehension, and I certainly don't enjoy it, but all of those things are a goad to make me go to God and trust Him for the outcome. So here's a nail for you. Every limitation you have in life is to teach you two things: eternity and humility. You see, when I realize I can't control things, I have to go to the God who's in control and say, listen, I can't do anything about this. You have to tackle this issue. It's beyond my control. When I can't comprehend things, I say, God, I don't understand this, but I know You do. Would You please take care of it? Because You have knowledge I'm not privy to. When somebody keeps moving the cheese, and it seems like no matter how many raises you get or bonuses you get, that you still can't find enough money to get from one end of the month to the other because of all these things that happen in your life, you need to go to God and say, I'm going to put You first financially, but I'm going to have to trust You to take care of the provision. You see, every limitation that God gives us is to make us, to goad us into turning back to Him. And that's something you can take to the bank. So I'm going to close the way Solomon closes in verse 14 in this chapter. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And God doeth it that men should fear before Him. Our lives are meant to focus on the eternal, not the temporal. All this kind of started when I was having a conversation with my son, and he didn't reveal who this was, so if it was you and you told my son this, you don't have to worry because I have no idea who it is. But he just told me that he had a friend that sometimes found it difficult to do what was godly because there was no immediate payback. You see, when you play a game and you win and you get a high score, there's immediate feedback. You can kind of say, well, hey, I beat that. And there's maybe a little bit of an epinephrine and serotonin high that comes from doing that. Or maybe you're at a sport and you compete at a sport and you win, and there's kind of that momentary high that comes from doing that. I saw my brother this week, and my brother is 16 years older than I am, but he's quite the athlete. And he He climbed two 14,000-foot mountains in Colorado, plus several other mountains. But it was an 18-mile hike up and an 18-mile hike back. And my brother, who's 16 years older than I am, did that in a day. And he was having to wait on everybody else who was trying to catch their breath because the air gets a lot thinner as you go up. And he was having no problems. And yet, I'm sure when he got up there, he got a high. My brother has a stack of what looks like are coasters at his house, and they're actually these metal geological brass mementos of somebody who's climbed to a certain height, and the U.S. Department of the Interior gives out these things showing, hey, you made it to the top and you survived. And so there's enough of them around his home. They look like coasters, but not everybody has those little things. And I'm sure there's a high from getting up there. But the reality is that the only thing that's going to endure forever is our worship to God and our service to God. That's all that's eternal. Now, I do want to point out one more thing. I think every one of you should have Ecclesiastes 3:14 circled in your Bible. And fact is, out next to Ecclesiastes 3:14 in your Bible, you should write Hebrews 10:14. And when you get to Hebrews 10:14, you should write Ecclesiastes 3:14 next to that, because Ecclesiastes 3:14 and Ecclesiastes 10:14 are so very important together. This verse says, whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it, and God doeth it that men should fear before Him. Hebrews 10:14 says, for by one offering He hath perfected forever them that are sanctified. Next time somebody tells you can lose your salvation, take them to these two verses. Whatever God does, He does forever. And then Hebrews says, for by one offering He is sanctified forever. He has perfected forever them that are sanctified. You see, God didn't want me able to mess up my salvation, so He made it permanent because He keeps it instead of me. So, what's the point? The point is, unless you're living for God, there's no point to this life, and you are of all men most miserable. And if somebody can't find a satisfaction in life, it's because they are looking for it in the components of life instead of the Creator. Would you stand with me as Richard comes and leads us in a song? I don't know if any of you can even identify with that feeling of, why am I still sucking up oxygen on this planet? I don't know if any of you can comprehend that feeling of, I feel like I'm in a rat race and there's no end to the tunnel, and all I'm doing is working to take care of others, and yet, what's the point of it all? Maybe you've never asked that question, but I will tell you, in the last few years, I've asked it a lot. I've wondered sometimes whether there was any relevance or any point to my life at all. And I now realize that Solomon had that problem. We all have that problem at a certain stage. What I want you to do this morning is, if you have experienced those, maybe you'll join me at the altar. Use this as a goad from God to seek to find life satisfaction in the Creator rather than the components of life. You're welcome to join me as I pray at the altar. Richard.
Creator. 388, wherever He leads me, I will follow.